This is Michael Kaiser, and you're listening to the Good Beer Hunting Podcast.
Good morning. I'm currently sitting in the car outside Blackback Pub in Waterbury, Vermont, waiting for one of my favorite bars in the country to open its doors. I came out to visit Hill Farmstead for the quarterly pickup of the membership club called Collected Works. It's my first time joining the club, which I mostly did as an excuse to force myself to visit more often. The place is buried in about a foot or two of snow at the moment, but it's as special as ever, and now my bags are full for the trip home. I'm also here for the weekend for a grafting workshop with Shaxbury Cider. A bunch of us are holing up in an old farmhouse and learning how to graft apple trees in an orchard outside of Middlebury, so I figure I better bring some bottles of Hill Farmstead's Dorothy to share, which is perhaps the best entry point to those beers, being as light and delicate as it is. As much as I admire these kinds of artisanal producers, who really speak to what I love about the ancient traditions of making these delicate, fermentation-driven beers and ciders, if you've been listening for a while, you know that another part of my brain is just as turned on by the business and strategy of running a contemporary craft brewery. Which brings us to this week's guest, Austin Beer Works, one of the best in that regard, and someone I've been following closely for a while now. They have a very strong brand, they're growing well, they self-distribute, and they know their market. They're really the quintessential case study for how to make and sell contemporary craft beer in a somewhat underdeveloped market, especially when you know that market won't stay that way for long. Very few do these days. So this is Austin Beer Works, pretty much the whole crew of them, representing a variety of skill sets and perspectives, but with a unified goal, to discuss the many facets of what constitutes their vision, strategy, and execution. Listen in.
All right. So, we are drinking, so this is one of my favorite brewers in the country. I'm a big fan of a lot of flavor, a little bit of alcohol. I know a lot of brewers tend to feel that way too.
Yeah.
Nice. Brewing out in Salem, Massachusetts. His whole thing is session beer from top to bottom. It's been kind of cool to see him grow. He's got a tap room now for the first time ever. And I've only been able to visit once and drink the beers, even though I was kind of a fan of the business for a long time and kind of his position and his voice. He's an ornery guy on Twitter in a way that I appreciate. But he sent us out a few swickles.
Awesome. That's
really cool. So this isn't available regularly here, huh?
No. Special. Although it'd be very nice. Notch, if it was regularly available here at the GBH studio.
Nudge.
Yeah. It was fantastic. Thanks for sharing.
Yeah. Thanks for making time out of your short trip to swing by the studio here and talk about what's going on down in Texas. Austin Beer Works. Mm-hmm. You guys have made a name for yourself far beyond your distribution footprint.
It's funny to think about that. I mean, I guess we have, and it's a funny thing about traveling, and I guess it's just something about... It's a small beer community, but yeah, word gets out, the power of the internet and stupid marketing tricks and everything else. But yeah, I'm always amazed at how many people have heard of us considering what a small kind of distribution footprint we have.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you had one of the better stupid marketing tricks that I've seen in a while with the 99 pack.
Yeah, we like to call that our best worst idea we've ever had.
So. Well, it got knocked off pretty recently.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That was a kind of a shocking thing about how, I mean, it was a dumb idea, but a great idea, and I'm surprised that nobody's done it before or since. And it's one thing to put a bunch of beers in a box, but to make it, you know, we intentionally made it as unwieldy and awkward as possible, and to copy that idea, you know, exact dimensions, I think, is what rubbed us the wrong way.
But. Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I think you could have made it more awkward. I mean, it was at least just like one long extruded looking rectangle. Right. It's not like you made it into like the letter N or anything.
Right. It could be much worse. You're right.
We did push the handles further out. So instead of making it comfortable, like a little bit more than shoulder width, move them further out. So you're like, unless you have a giant wingspan, you're not one person lifting it.
The original idea was to search the city for pairs of rollerblades at the consignment shops and then, you know, just duct tape those on the end and that's how you got it out of the store. But
it's a tail dragger.
Yeah.
That's a really specific use case.
Yeah, right? Get a 99 pack, get a sweet set of blades with it, you know?
Really, you'd only get one.
Yeah, that's true.
Hopefully you get one blade, you can wheelbarrow the thing. tell us, you've already told me a little bit, but tell our audience, like, why, you've been in Chicago twice recently, which sort of caught my attention just as, you know, why would you be here? I immediately started thinking about distribution deals and things like that. But of course, you're talking about something much more tangible and technical in the printing of the cans themselves.
Yeah. You know, I mean, I love Chicago and have nothing against Chicago, but we're, you know, I think you touch on it a lot in your podcast, and I agree with it. There's really no reason for us to be here. I think, you know, not right now. We get an occasional email from somebody that maybe in the Chicagoland area, like, is your beer available here? But we're not getting our doors beat down by Chicago, you know, by Jewel Osco or you know, anybody, like, get here as soon as you can. And even if that was happening, I guess we wouldn't have the capacity to do it. But so, yeah, it's not really a business trip other than there's a can manufacturing facility here called Ardagh, which is just one of the few. There's basically three manufacturers of cans, I guess, in the world these days. And this is the one group that we hadn't worked with. And so we were getting all of our cans sort of approved through their facility just to have one more option. And I think we've been the happiest with their customer service and quality. And I think we're going to switch all of our core brands over to their facility. So we're just here to do a few design tweaks while we have the opportunity to, and dial in all our colors and just make sure everything goes well. And then also we have one brand new brand that we made for the first time today that we're super, super excited about.
Oh, nice. Yeah. I mean, it's no small deal to switch over a supplier of anything at your size. I mean, especially when you're talking about, I mean, for a small craft brewery, anytime you switch a supplier of anything, it has a dramatic effect on costs, the quality of the thing that you're going to get. Like, it's a massive switch.
It is. Yeah. I mean, it's taken that, and this is a multi-year process, I guess, I think the first time that we met the sales rep for this company was 4 years ago.
Maybe five.
And you know, something we've kept in the back of our mind and kind of have revisited from time to time, but just the market's always changing and currently it makes sense to make the switch.
Yeah, and I would suppose it speaks a little bit to the growth of the business overall and how you guys are thinking about the future if you're talking about, you know, a can supplier this far away from home. Like, it's much as craft beer is like a small local thing in its home market, it's about where that beer's made.
Yeah.
All the pieces that go into that local product come from far and wide.
Yeah, and that's a downside for working with these guys is there's our current supplier has a plant in Fort Worth, so just a couple hours up the road.
That makes press checks a lot easier.
it does. Well, yes and no, and the really great thing about this company, about Ardagh, is they have, it's basically a pilot printing facility, so they do very small runs, and they can run 10, 20 cans at a time. So you can really, really dial it in kind of in a low pressure situation. The big plants, they print 2,000 cans a minute, and you have to make tweaks on the fly while these cans are just flying by, basically going in the trash. And they kind of, you know, it's very high pressure, like make a decision right now. Like we're you know, this isn't cheap, you know? I think that, customer service wise and quality wise, this is a better system
like
for somebody of our size.
Yeah, it's scaled appropriately. I remember I used to spend summers working in an extruded plastic pipe manufacturing plant. And as much product as they produced on a single shift, the biggest single driver of that business was how seldom you had a changeover between different kinds of pipes and diameters and whether it was perforated or not. And any of those things was a dramatic, like somebody was making a decision that they knew was going to cost a lot of money. That was unfortunate. But a lot of suppliers for these kinds of things that small craft brewers are relying on are built for much larger volumes, and not all of those businesses. I mean, we see it in the way we buy hops and malt and things like that, starting to scale down into more expensive but scaled better for craft brewers. And now I think we're starting to see that even on the supply of packaging as well. All of that's going to help the future.
Yeah, it's kind of a crazy thing too with can manufacturers, and I won't dwell on this too long, but you know, for them to even look at craft brewers that are of our size, you know, we're a blip on the radar. So
sure.
it's
a changeover.
Yeah, a changeover. And, it, you know, for them, it takes almost more time to change over the line than it does to run the cans themselves. So it's been tough to get good customer service out of a large manufacturer like that. But I think some of the guys are starting to get it. But it'll be a little while before it's really kind of conducive for craft brewers to print, you know, full labels instead of buying brights or silver cans.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, because even on the brewery side, then you have to store all that. You're talking about a pretty big run, a container full at least.
Yeah, full semi. So. Yeah. Per brand.
25 pallets per truck, and you take a full truck order each time. And you got four brands. That's 100 pallets. That's a lot of real estate, a lot of building.
It's a terrible time to find a typo.
It's funny you should mention it. We had some 16-ounce cans a few years ago that said 355 milliliters on the 16-ounce can, which obviously it's, what, 473.
Mm-hmm.
The owner of Maui Brewing, I'd taken some beer out there on vacation, and he sent me a text message. Garrett's like, hey, brada, you got a typo.
We got enough, yeah.
Thanks, Garrett.
We'd get an email every couple months from, you know, from somebody very observant. We'd have to basically have a form response saying that we put that on there so we could identify communists, and we've ordered your appropriate agency.
Tell me about, we've been talking about can manufacturers in the Midwest. Tell me about Austin. What, culturally speaking, like where is craft beer in Austin relative to some of the other places you guys have been able to frequent?
Sure.
It's a great craft beer town. I mean, put simply, you know, when we opened up in 2011, there were only a couple, you know, handful of breweries. Statewide, we had 37 breweries when we opened, and now we've got over 250 in the state. But, I mean, Austin certainly, you know, I don't think it's a secret. It's certainly the epicenter of craft beer in the state. I think we have roughly 50 breweries of the entire, you know, in the greater Austin area, which is a pretty significant number, you know.
Yeah, I don't think I realized it was that dense.
Yeah, and that includes brew pubs and breweries. The state treats them differently. But as far as we're all concerned, we're all brewers.
Mm-hmm.
It's really, yeah, I mean, it's really come a long way in a short amount of time, just with the number of breweries opening, but just in the sort of the recognition that it's gotten to with, you know, Jester King is probably the most famous Austin area brewery that, you know, worldwide, I think a lot of people have heard of them. But then ABGB is a brew pub in Austin who has won Brew Pub of the Year the last 2 years and have just been killing it with all of their lager beers. And I forget the number of gold medals that came from Austin.
He was seven this year.
It was great. I mean, yeah, so the quality of beer is just, and that's across the board of all different spectrums of styles. It's just turned into an amazing beer town. It always has been. We've always consumed a lot of beer. Just there weren't a lot of local options until fairly recently.
Yeah. Is there anything, are there any particular, you know, elements of the beer scene in Austin you feel like really defines it apart from anybody else? Like,
sure.
I always peg Chicago as probably the most diverse in terms of beer styles being made, and obviously a place like San Diego just like hangs their shingle on IPA. Is there something about Austin that has sort of like it shakes out into a few different things?
Sure. I mean, it's kind of funny because I think a lot of Austinites consider our town, you know, an IPA town, but I think a good portion of the beers that brought home medals this year were for lager beer, pilsners, and just lager beers in general. And I think that's really starting to become the spot where Austin and Texas is kind of shining is lager beers of all type. You know, we love hoppy lager beers, and we've been doing a lot of experimentation with that. But also the people in Austin are viciously loyal to local brands, so that helps a lot.
And mm-hmm.
I think we have the most licenses to sell alcohol in one zip code than anywhere else in the nation, too, so that helps a lot.
Yeah.
But so lager beers and hoppy beers are kind of leading the charge. You know, we've got Joe Moorfeld from Pinehouse Pizza is in town, and he's doing some of the most outrageous hoppy beers I've ever tasted, you know, and it's a wonderful thing to live close to.
Yeah. Tell me about the experimentation in lager beer. Like, what are some of the things that people have been pushing on?
Sure. So we're doing a lot of stuff with, like, biotransformation. And, you know, I don't know how savvy everybody is in that, but...
Not very. I mean, that's pretty easy to answer.
Sure.
It's a made-up word.
Yeah, right?
We can go
there.
It
sounds good, though, right? So just, you know, playing with different yeasts and the whole idea, and, you know, it's really popular in the whole New England IPA kind of craze right now, is you add hops under certain situations and during certain fermentation situations, and some of the oils will actually biotransform during the fermentation into other oils. So it produces this really juice-heavy, kind of crazy, not bitter, but super flavorful hoppy beers. And Sapporo started doing some research on this years ago and gave a presentation at the MBAA, I believe, in Austin. And, yeah, man, it's wild. We've experimented with it a lot, and it produces beers that you you won't taste flavors like that anywhere else.
So. Yeah, I mean, especially not in a lager.
Yeah.
That's a pretty new idea. Were you at that presentation?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so was that the start of you thinking that way?
Yeah, that's. I think you could see the light bulb above a ton of brewers' heads in that room, and it was just like, oh my God, what's going on?
Yeah.
It's so funny because I think they kind of presented it as a defect, like yeah. don't do this or it's going to change your hops into this. And like that's what
it's
we want,
taste right? Juice. So, yeah.
There's so much ironic money spent on research that transforms craft beer in the direction it wasn't intended to go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I mean, so much of what we know about hops in general right now is funded by decades of macrobrewer and agricultural research that they've invested in to get a totally different outcome than mm-hmm. what we're now employing it for.
Right. Thank
yeah,
y'all.
That's remarkable. Yeah. Put them on the Christmas card list.
Yeah, right. But yeah, I mean, and going back to Austin too, I mean, that all is true. But it always sinks in traveling around, but especially just on our 1.5 block walk from our car to your studio here, it's 15 degrees outside and it hurts. And I'm not really, I mean, this is a delicious Pilsner, but like, I think I would crave Pilsners less here in this climate than I would. In Austin,
yeah.
I'm always kind of amazed at how much climate affects my appetite for food and drink.
Mm-hmm.
But Austin is a hot, humid climate. I think, you know, we average, I don't know, 90 days over 100 a year or something like that.
Mm-hmm. It's at 70 degrees today in Austin. So, I mean, we're already, you know, approaching springtime. January and February tend to be our cold months.
Right.
So, you know, 70 degrees.
It's amazing to me how much climate affects, you know, what you want to drink. And also the opposite of that sometimes is like how much a drinking culture wants something despite the climate.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, as much as, you know, a place like San Diego is very IPA driven and a lot of that fits with the climate, they'll also drink, you know, huge Imperial Adjunct stouts all year round just because like they're nerds and they're into that stuff and
right.
nothing seems to affect them in terms of natural biorhythms.
IPA seems to be immune to climate for
yeah,
some reason.
It sure
yeah,
does.
Yeah, you can, I mean, it can be appreciated year-round.
Now, I know one of the other things you guys have been working really hard on down in Texas is beer laws. And I know this group has a particularly strong connection to what's going on down there. Can you lay the groundwork for us a little bit first on kind of the state of the state, I suppose? I think we could start by saying I think it's the last remaining state in the union where you can't do direct package sale.
Correct.
Or something along those lines.
Yeah,
Georgia
sure.
having just beaten you to that punch.
Well, yeah, when Alabama's in front of you, you know you're in trouble. So, 49 other states in the U.S. allow to-go sales, and Texas, we're the only ones who don't. So 93% of Americans get to enjoy rights that Texans do not.
Yeah.
And that's just
that's not a very Texan idea.
That's completely antithetical to what most Texans would have you believe. And
yeah.
Of course, I was born and raised in Austin. It's my hometown. My wife and I got married on the seal of the state capitol. And so it's very personal. She's worked in politics her entire career, and I've worked in beer now for more than 10 years. And it's a very personal issue for us because it's our entire livelihood on both sides, on the side of beer law, but then also on the side of politics for her. And so,
well, why is that? I don't think I understand the connection.
It's very personal because it's how we live.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and when the laws are,
does she work on the legal side of things?
She worked in the state legislature for two sessions. She works for the State Trauma Foundation now, so beer law doesn't necessarily affect her day in and day out work, but it certainly affects our quality of life because, you know, and we'll see each other and high five each other sometimes in the halls of the Capitol, you know, when she's going to some office and I'm going to some other office or whatever.
Mm-hmm. I think just living in that world makes her probably hypersensitive to the various machinations that go on to why the laws are the way they are in Texas versus elsewhere and the kind of the powers at play, you know, she gets a back, you know.
Yeah, when I should make mention, in 2013, we got the right to sell beer for on-premise consumption, but there is an onerous bad piece of legislation that got attached to it that ultimately became law. And when it was backed by the wholesalers in our state, the Wholesale Beer Distributors of Texas were primarily behind that piece of legislation. It was Senate Bill 639, which basically made it illegal for craft brewers or for brewers of any kind to sell their territorial distribution rights as an asset. So it literally took value away from every brewery in the state of Texas and basically just got rid of it, which is a pretty interesting, crazy thing. Several of our brewers across the state filed suit. It was won, and then the state appealed it, and the state won, and now it's going to the state Supreme Court for final arbitration sometime in the next year. is our understanding. So, but it was interesting in 2013 when they were shopping that bad bill around. My wife was in office of Representative Larry Gonzalez. He's a Republican from Round Rock, which is the north suburb of Austin. And the WBDT's lobbyist came in saying that craft brewers want this and it's good for craft brewers. And my wife was like, no, you're lying. You're literally lying. And because my wife told her she was lying, my wife got fired the next day.
Jeez.
To give you an idea, it literally was just because of that. Her boss told her so. So it's just kind of interesting. Representative Gonzalez is on his way out now. He's chosen not to run again. So, you know, and it's funny because he's a, you know, by all accounts, he's a pro free market, you know, the kind of Texan you would expect to be completely behind craft brewers. And yet he wasn't.
Yeah.
At least
for some politicians, part of the free market is how much their votes are worth as well.
Definitely. So just to continue down this path, we were very successful in 2013. We had some champions in the state legislature who wanted to see some legislative change take place. And we had kind of a critical mass between public, public opinion and desires to see the laws change. And so it was sort of a perfect storm, and we were able to get the right to actually have tap rooms. Because again, that was something uniquely Texan, that we could not sell you a drop of beer. We could give it away all day long, mm-hmm. but we couldn't sell a drop of beer. And so tap rooms have really just been a recent invention in Texas. You know, we opened ours at the end of 2013 when the bill became law in September of 2013, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
So,
and that's roughly similar to what was happening in Georgia. Like, you could have a tap room, but it was basically there to serve free samples you had to give away at the end of a tour or something like that. Or somebody could just walk in and demand it. And you weren't allowed to say no.
Correct.
Which was sort of an interesting model.
But what we've seen since 2013 is that the wholesalers have started pushing little pieces of legislation to actually chip away and try to remove some of the rights that we've been able to gain, such that in 2017, just, you know, a few months ago, they actually passed a bill, another, you know, kind of onerous bill. And really what it did was it took us off of our offensive game and actually put us in full defense mode. And it's another bill that takes rights away from craft brewers in our state.
Yeah.
And that was House Bill 3287. But basically it sets an artificial limit for success for what a craft brewer can ever hope to attain in the state of Texas. And again, as a native born Texan, you know, the prospect of doing business in Oklahoma or Louisiana or New Mexico is superior to doing business in Texas. And every Texan should be ashamed to hear such a terrible statement.
Yeah.
Nobody should be proud of that in our state, at least of all the legislators. So
we've got a bit to unpack here. I want to unpack it in a way that's a little bit more tangible for our audience who are probably tuning into this specific thing a little more for the first time. But I think there's some universal principles at play here. So making it possible to do direct sale in your own tap room at least gave you a direct relationship with your customer for the first time. It made them customers. And that was a big deal. But there were limits put on that. Mm-hmm. I think it was an overall barrel limit that you were allowed to produce and have a tap room, something like that, right?
Correct.
Yes, and those limits are, I think, in line with what's, I mean, you know, you could always want more. I believe it's 225,000 barrels.
Mm-hmm. 225,000, you can have a tap room and sell up to 5,000 barrels for on-premise consumption.
5,000 barrels on-premise. So that's roughly the size of, you know, an Oscar Blues, for example.
Correct.
A single brewery.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they happen to be in Austin, so they kind of put them right on the line.
Correct.
And immediately made that rule value their business very differently than they had valued it prior to that rule, where if tap rooms had been made available to them with no cap, they didn't have to worry about which decision they were making. But
this is where it gets kind of interesting. So that was the initial law, 225,000 barrels, and that was per brewery, per location.
Right.
And this latest set, the 3287, which Adam was talking about, it ties ownership, all locations all over the world together with any even 1% common ownership. No, it's 20. They made it 25.
They made 25%.
They made it
so that effectively tied any corporate brewers, such as an AB InBev or a Miller Coors, tied their overall barrelage to the barrelage of the brewery operating just within Texas.
But like don't worry about those guys, because they were able to get a carve out in the piece of legislation to give them up to 3 locations in Texas,
right,
where they could make additional acquisitions or open additional car box or additional revolvers or whomever. So,
yep.
So they got what they wanted, you know, when it was all said and done. And ultimately, you know, all the inside baseball aside, you know, they lobbied very heavily, and they basically lobbied that bill back alive. We had mounted a very effective campaign to try to kill the bill. And we thought we actually had it on a Thursday. The votes were against it.
It sure looked like it.
On Thursday, the votes were against it. On Friday, it passed.
Yeah.
And so it's like, well, how on earth did that happen? We come to find out that AV's lobbyists, they struck a deal.
Really nice flowers.
Well, let's go back to this 225,000 barrel limit. Why do you think that that was the number that the wholesalers would peg? What was the strategic advantage of a number like that?
I don't know. I think probably, you know, back in 2013 when the original law was written, we weren't at the table. We were part of the overall kind of conglomeration of craft brewers. We didn't have a very centralized or unified legislative committee. It existed, but there weren't really any rules. And so we were all kind of on the outside with our legislative committee chairman, kind of making the sausage. And I believe that we had originally asked for higher numbers, and that's what it got negotiated down to.
Yes,
but, 225,000 barrels is less than 0.1% of the overall beer market.
Yeah.
You know, so it's a pretty small number when you really start thinking about it more, holistically, or thinking about it in the larger scheme of things.
So when it gets compromised down to that number, somebody's going to get caught close to that line, even though most of the brewers in the state numerically are probably not going to get anywhere near that if they're small. You know, like a smaller independent brewer is going to look at a number like that and be like, God, I hope to have that problem someday.
Yeah.
But what it does do, and I learned this from talking to Scott Metzger a little bit, who I'm sure you all know, is it puts a cap on the potential future growth of his company, which changes the valuation of his company. Mm-hmm. So
completely.
Even though he might never actually hit 225,000, it now looks to an investor like he's not even allowed to under his current business model.
And it
narrows the pool of potential investors. If you have an investor who has invested in other breweries, that's going to tie all of your production together, and that's going to limit, lower that limit. That limit applies to tap rooms too. It's 5,000 barrels for tap rooms across the entire world.
So that actually might have, okay.
So if you have 4,000 barrels.
Learning on the job here, just a little bit.
Oh yeah, I know.
Actually starts to look like a strategic advantage against private equity. Once you do the carve outs for the large corporate brewers, that number starts to hurt private equity more than anything, because they can only invest in so many because of shared ownership.
Which ultimately hurts, the economic opportunities for the state of Texas, too. So it's cutting off your nose to spite your face.
Yeah.
It just doesn't make sense.
But it really diminishes the avenues for raising capital, for investment.
Right.
For
limits your options.
Especially, the people that value breweries the most are either other brewers or, people in the beverage industry, people in the space already who have probably already made similar investments. It kind of really narrows the pool of potential investors.
Now, one of the other things you brought up in the limitations on some of that is that it nixed the idea that you could create equity in your own distribution rights and then sell those to a distributor. And I know that's sort of an ongoing new kind of frontier for the rights for distribution, because distributors will sell the rights from brands to each other. They're able to look at like a 5-year, 3 to 5 year markup on what they think that brand's going to be worth if they move it from one distribution house to another. However, in some cases, brewers are now creating their own brand equity long before they ever sign up with a distributor because they're self-distributing.
Mm-hmm.
They're creating all that value. And it's now becoming a question of, well, shouldn't that distributor have to pay the brewery for the equity rights of that brand? And we're seeing some of that happen with Sun King, for example, in Indiana, made that sale. They made it to a Blue House, a Miller House. And the AB house said, oh, no, you're not allowed to do that.
Right.
And so it became a pretty big battle there that is somewhat still unresolved in kind of a gray area, but they moved forward with it. And that gave them the money they needed for the expansion they wanted to do, which feels due. Right?
Sure.
They created that value.
Well,
but the law you're talking about stripped the possibility of that equity value being exchanged from a brewer to a distributor.
Explicitly, yeah. I mean, and that's why one of the reasons it's so near and dear to us, we're a self-distributing brewery, so we self-distributed. We have been from day one self-distributed 100% of our beer, which last year it was about 20,000 barrels. So it's a lot of,
It's not small.
It's not small.
That's a ton of self-distribution.
It is. And when you start applying those multiples to that amount of beer, I mean, that's real. I mean, that's in the millions. That's a real asset that was just artificially legislated away. So it's a pretty bum deal.
And that kind of, and being able to look at the future equity payoff of those rights, if you choose to go the distribution route, pays for all the investment you put into those trucks and people up until that point. Without that payoff, you're really just investing in something temporarily. That what do you do with all of that at that point?
Yeah, and honestly, I mean, that's a theoretical and it's true. I mean, it does. It's a very real, tangible asset that was taken away. I don't think even if we were able to sell our distribution rights, just philosophically, we enjoy self-distribution so much and think that that's been a really key factor to our success. And it just makes sense in the market that we happen to be in, that Austin is a very compact city with a lot of accounts that makes it, I mean, it's set up very well for self-distribution.
Yeah.
And, but still the philosophical taking of, you know, of something that is extremely valuable is, I don't know, it's beyond frustrating that it ended up with.
I can feel you itching that place.
You know, distribution is really hard. It's logistically so many moving parts, and it's not just delivering beer. It's cleaning lines, it's stocking shelves. There's a lot of other stuff to it. And distributors are really good at that. What we're good at, though, is starting a company, starting brands, getting that initial traction going, proving that. In an ideal world, once you've kind of proven yourself as a viable brand that people want to buy, you can then, you know, do some initial distribution, gain that traction, and then move on and use a distributor to really do the physical heavy lifting. And when they take away the value of it, they really change the whole equation, and not necessarily in their favor.
Mm. I mean, it's basically a business within the business, and that business should have value.
Right? Yeah.
And it certainly should have a free market value. Mm-hmm. It shouldn't be legislated in a way that prevents that from being bought and sold.
And then the other portion of that, too, is that, you know, they've taken the value away of those rights, but once you sign that deal with them, that's for life.
Yeah.
You can't get it back, you know, and...
Well, they can sell it, then they, you know,
yeah,
if you sign with them, they can sell it that same day to another distributor.
Right.
And can't, you know, I mean...
They can essentially just flip it.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, with immediate apparent value that you were not allowed to transact with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
And we don't have any say in that either, so, you know, should we go down that road?
The whole brewer distributor, and it should be a partnership. You're trying to both grow together, but they've made it a very much a one side of the equation, and that's just inherent.
Are you allowed to have signing bonuses or anything like that when you sign up with the distributor?
Cannot have any cash.
Are there any mechanisms whatsoever that way?
There are. I believe you can. I mean, you can always negotiate
marketing dollars, right?
Yeah, market spend.
Yeah.
You know, your margins, you can...
But no, like, instant financial instrument in place like that?
No, you know, that was it. That was explicitly allowed.
It seems like if somebody could figure it out, they could just sign up, essentially, like a broker.
Right.
Sell it to me, I'll sell it to the distributor and give you half. Everybody just went silent.
Yeah.
I guarantee there'd be a tier violation in there somewhere.
Yeah, I don't know. Sell it to another state and have them sell it back in.
But you know, me, I'm going to go start a business real quick.
So, you know, you can tell, I mean, we're all passionate about this. And I think the atmosphere in Texas is pretty contentious right now, at least we feel, between specifically small brewers and distributors, at least the lobbies of both of our lobbies. But we're not anti-distributor by any means, and think that they create enormous value under the right circumstances. It just you know, and actually, I mean, shout out to y'all, like the Bob Collins interview. Mm-hmm. Windy City seems like the fantastic distributor that gets it, and that, I mean, it gets building brands. But I make all of our sales guys listen to that interview. I mean, it's fantastic. Mm-hmm. Just the philosophy behind how he approaches customer relationships and everything else like that comes from a lot of experience and really understanding the market. And I think that, you know, that the right distributors create enormous value. Just
I think sometimes the way I would sometimes describe Windy City, as excellent as I think they are a weapon forged in a battle like Chicago.
Sure.
I don't think there's a distributor that exists the way that they do if they didn't have to find their own way as a craft only distributor for so many years in a place like Chicago that is, I mean, on its face, corrupt and highly competitive. We're also the most distributed to market.
Right.
Pay to play is not a stranger here. It's been part of the system forever. To be able to find your way and be effective through all of that, I think forces you to become a certain kind of animal. It's been very interesting to watch them develop over the years. I guess when you guys start thinking about the limitations that might be in place for that, I mean, 20,000 barrels in the Austin area, how far out in Texas do you go right now?
About 50 miles from the brewery, we just opened up a new market, a city called New Braunfels, which is sort of two-thirds of the way between us and San Antonio. San Antonio is the closest other major market to us, but really, I'd say, you know, 19,000 of those barrels is probably within about 15 miles of the brewery.
Jesus, that's stupid.
It really is. I know. In a town with 50 other breweries, like that, you know, that we could sell that much beer is constantly surprising.
Yeah, what do you think the factors are? I mean, I can tell already because you're Texans, you're going to be a little reluctant to pat yourselves on the back, but what are the factors that go into making 20,000 barrels in a 50-mile radius in Austin possible? You're not that old.
Yeah, no, we're coming up on our seventh year, and I think what sets our brewery specifically apart is our clear delineation of labor and skill sets between the four of us owners. We're four partners that, you know, started and run it. And not trying to cross over too much into each other's worlds. You know, we wear a lot of hats and we help each other, but that clear kind of division of what we are good at and what we do,
mm-hmm.
I think really set us apart and set us up for success as far as having clear views and being able to focus on, okay, we need to do this to make this much beer, to cellar it, to, you know, what type of plant we need to build, to marketing and sales, and then ultimately distributing that much beer. And I think we do a fair job at it.
GBH is made possible by the financial contributions of our underwriters. Guinness is helping us bring you a completely new series of stories called Coming to America, featuring upstart and iconic breweries from around the world who are trying to make their way in the U.S. in the age of local. As part of the Guinness Coming to America section, we'll be featuring new wave breweries as well as long-standing imports, like this month's focus on Brasserie du Bessin, a Belgian brewery older than Belgium itself. We've just taken on New Belgium as an underwriter as well, who'll be helping focus on the evolving world of specialty beers, especially wild and sour, as drinkers around the world seek out new beer experiences that increasingly occupy a place in our lives once reserved for wine. How do we talk about these beers, buy and sell them, integrate them into new bar and restaurant concepts? We'll be publishing stories in that vein shortly. We're also supported by the Fervent Few, a growing community of GBH fans, including some professional supporters. From the UK, we have Cloudwater Brew Co., Four Pure Brewing Company, Magic Rock, Honest Brew, Siren Craft Brew, Two Tribes, Beer Hawk, Northern Monk Brew Co., The 5 Points Brewing Company, London Fields Brewery, Boundary Brewing in Belfast, and Ireland Craft Beers, an exporter. In the U.S., we have The Mitten Bar in Ludington, Michigan, Lord Hobo in Massachusetts, Sound Growler Brewing in Tinley Park, Illinois, 1911 Established Cider and Spirits from New York, and then there's Devil's Peak of Signal Hill Products in Cape Town, South Africa, all supporting us through their monthly pro-tier subscriptions. You can join the Firm Few by visiting patreon.com/goodbeerhunting or go to goodbeerhunting.com/ferventfew.
Yeah, break down your roles a little bit. I mean, we've got four of you in the room right here. Help me understand what you all do.
So my name's Will Golden. I'm the director of brewing operations. So I run basically raw materials, brew house operations, fermentation science, as well as Adam helps me with the fermentation science as well.
Okay. And what do you focus on?
So, I mean, I'm a brewer by trade, but I got my career started in the cellar. So when I think about it, you know, the cellar is my favorite part of the brewery. But as time's gone on, I've really morphed into the operations, plant operations manager. So I do most of the proving for the majority of our capital improvements. So all of our tanks and infrastructure, chillers, piping, CO2, you name it, boiler. And so pretty much anymore, yeah, you know, we'll say what we need to start on a project, and, you know, I'll go to the books and I'll, you know, see who we've worked with in the past and, you know, talk to the different suppliers and prove out what it is that we're trying to accomplish.
Yeah, you're basically a GC.
to an extent, you know, and then when things break, you know, largely that's my job is to fix them as well. So yeah. I'm kind of a troubleshooter. Problem solving is kind of one of my favorite things. And so I think that's kind of how I got, you know, so involved in our guild operations as well. So I'm just now beginning my fourth year on the board of directors for our state guild. I'll be up for re-election at the end of the year. Hopefully I get re-elected. But, you know, yeah, to me, it's all about problem solving, just trying to figure out a better way to do things. And, you know, I think that's what I bring to the table, hopefully.
Even when it comes to the legal side.
Yeah. It's, ironically, I worked in law enforcement for 3 years prior to getting into the beer industry. And so I've actually got a master's degree in criminal justice. And so that whole career was all about problem solving as well, trying to figure out what makes people do what they do. You know? So It all comes together, I promise.
Adam's also a master at finding deals on either used equipment or I don't even know where he finds half this stuff, but you know, kegging line, rebuild it, get it up and running, and thing works flawlessly.
Yeah. Mm. Pardon my language, but we like to call him an eBay whore.
Don't give away my secrets. Yeah.
Sorry. Yeah.
About yourself?
I'm on the computer a lot. Whatever that means. I think mostly sales and marketing. Mm-hmm. I get to work, kind of be the direct link to our branding partner, Helms Workshop, mm-hmm. in Austin, and discuss what usually start off as really, really dumb ideas, and then they polish into kind of dumb ideas that look really nice, which is my favorite part of the job. But I'm also, I do the social media and respond to positive and negative, customer commentary. I do a production planning, so trying to make sure it's part of sales, but that we produce and maintain sufficient inventory of whatever brand, and then most of the government compliance stuff too. So when it comes down to doing the monthly excise tax reports and all that fun stuff, yeah. I'm putting all the numbers together.
Did you slip anything fun through during the government shutdown?
If I
owned a brewery, that I would just be waiting for government shutdowns,
right?
Just trying to throw something into market real quick.
Right. No, I think we missed our window. I probably could have, but no, we. We're rule followers in general. Yeah.
What about you?
This is Mike McGovern. I get all the fun stuff, all the stuff that these guys are real jealous about not having to do. So HR and actually the big one is distribution. So we're self-distributed, as we said. So that's actually delivering the beer, then also the draft techs, cleaning lines, maintaining lines. So we got a fleet of nearly 20 vehicles now. So. The self-distribution side is probably the biggest part of my day, then HR, and then the end-of-year books, all the financing side of things.
So. That's 1,000 barrels per vehicle. Tell me more about the draft system maintenance that you're performing, because that's not always, it depends on, what city you're talking about or what state you're in, yeah. and what you're allowed to do and things like that. How does that fit into the distribution part for you?
Yeah, so there's no set state law or requirements on how often you have to clean the lines or anything. The only law that there is we're only allowed to work on what the beer touches.
Hmm.
So basically from the keg coupler through the line, strangely not the faucet. I think it just got left out on the law when it was written. But yes, if there's any just maintenance issues, I've got a team of guys that can fix it. But then the line cleaning is really the most important part. We spend so much time and effort making sure the raw materials are good, making sure the brew house is hitting their targets, cellar making sure they're hitting their targets, packaging, keeping their DO levels low, and those guys spend 90% of their time cleaning. But if it gets to the customer and it's going through dirty lines, none of that other stuff matters. You've lost it right there. So we're real adamant on maintaining 2 weeks between cleanings, and then really even just educating our guys on what to do or how to clean it. So not just the draft techs, but the drivers.
Hmm.
So the drivers, if they're at an account and they see something, they've been trained to also step in and clean the lines or fix the lines or do whatnot.
Now, will they actually just go ahead and clean all of the lines for a visit like that? How does that, is that set up as like a service that you offer? I really have no idea. A service you offer or just a troubleshooting thing when needed, or how do you guys approach that?
Well, for any of our lines, our goal is we're going to clean a line once every 2 weeks.
Okay. For a line that your beer is on.
A line that our beer is on. The only time we'll clean an additional line is if you use a beer pump, then you need to do it in even pairs.
I see.
You need a supply and then a return. So if you're using the pump on that, then you can pick up someone else's line.
Yeah.
Or if we sometimes will ask accounts if we can move our tap handles together. In that case, we'll clean, let's say, 3 lines. So we'll move 2 of ours together and then clean the line that we're moving the other one to.
Gotcha. I realize now why my question actually doesn't make a whole lot of sense. I'm thinking about Rotation Nation, which is what happens here in Chicago, but 20,000 barrels in a 50-mile radius, you've got a lot of lines where you're just always on.
Well, the rotation is still tough because we'll drop off a keg on, let's say, a Tuesday, but it might not go on until Friday, might not go on until the following week. So that's actually one of the tougher things, especially if you're getting a lighter beer going on after something that some of them do leave an impart.
And not your father's root beer or something?
I think those will just, you know, tear out the line and build it anew. I don't think we're reusing those.
So we have nine brinks?
Yeah, nine.
Nine brinks. Well, nine full-size brinks. But then even the sales reps, we bought them kind of mini one-gallon brinks. Hmm. So the sales reps can even... and they're really for the rotation nation.
Right.
If they've got a special beer coming on, and then even the sales reps will step in and do it.
But on top of that, we have two full-time draft techs who that's their full job is to, you know, maintain systems and
get the lines going. Yeah, they kind of maintain the relationship too. So they go around and kind of schedule around when those accounts want their stuff clean because you don't want to show up at lunchtime and try and clean somebody's lines. You probably won't be welcome back.
Right.
And every Monday morning, I get a list of the number and which accounts are outside the 2-week limit.
Hmm.
What's really cool, though, is there's never been a real study on like how often lines should be cleaned or if a drier beer or sweeter beer needs to be cleaned more or less. I think the BA is just wrapping up a very long study. So actually kind of excited to see the results.
Yeah, that would be super informative. Because it's mostly just... The study is just based on a default of whatever they decided beer was.
Yeah, but beer has changed so much.
Yeah.
It just all the styles out there. Why would you clean a filtered Pilsner as much as a,
to think maybe you can let that go for a couple months.
Yeah, fruited sour.
I'm not sure I'm going to do a couple months, but. Yeah.
I mean, it sounds like a pretty robust operation within the brewery to be doing all that self-distribution line. I mean... The service you just described is already bigger than, I think, our biggest line cleaning service here in Chicago, which is really well known and really good at it. But, I mean, you already have more techs than they do, I think, just servicing your own lines. I mean, that sounds like as big an operation as the brewery itself. At 20,000 barrels, do you guys have a number in mind where it just stops making sense to self-distribute? Or do you feel confident in your ability to grow that part of the operation incrementally to meet your needs?
There's 40,000 barrels is the limit.
The legal limit.
That's the legal limit.
Oh, okay.
And that's between, again, all entities worldwide. That was part of that bill basically just tied, the main thing it did was tie every brewery that you have an interest in together.
Yeah.
For every metric. But that's one of them. So we're halfway there.
What happens then?
Hopefully
you change the law before then, right?
Well, then, or maybe we come sell some beer here in Chicago, or maybe we go to Denver, or we go to San Diego, but we're not going to go to Dallas with one of the wholesale beer distributors of Texas, because every dollar we're going to make for those guys is going to be a dollar they're going to spend against us in our state house. They spent $18 million over the last 10 years in our state house. That's more money than anybody else, including oil.
Man.
So that should give you an idea of what those guys are willing to do. So
do you think they thought ahead and thought that they might be alienating the brands that they would want in the future from ever signing up?
They know for sure that, there's going to be a few guys like us, but there's probably going to be a whole lot more guys who are willing to do a deal with them, for the opportunity to get access to markets. You know, it's still a very big deal in our state. I mean, we've got, four of the top 15 largest breweries or cities in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
Are in Texas, and those markets are very lucrative beer markets, it's 28 million people in our state at this point.
Yeah.
So. Yeah, there are quite a few startup breweries. They start self-distributing and quickly realize that they didn't want to get into that business. They didn't want to get into the shelf stocking, the line cleaning, the running vans and everything else. So they actually, shortly thereafter, will sign with a distributor and just kind of give in.
Yeah, we'll dance with the devil on that one.
Now, I'll tell you what, though. The wholesalers, give them credit where it's due because they do a great job of getting beer to market. And they do clean the lines. They, back to what Michael said a little bit ago, we're not anti-distributor. And I also want to just kind of clarify one other thing. We're not anti-three-tier system. We actually believe in the sanctity of the three tiers. But our three-tier laws were written mostly in the 1930s, and they got updated in the 1970s. But here we are in 2018, and so imagine driving a car from the 1930s that had one set of updates in the 70s, 85 miles an hour down the interstate, that's not good for anybody,
Mm-hmm.
And so all we're really trying to accomplish is modernizing the three-tier system.
Well, what do you think that looks like?
We have 49 other states to get inspiration from that have it.
Well, they've also, I would imagine that those wholesalers in Texas have had the luxury of watching what happened in other states. and use that as, in, you know, as really strong data points for how they would want to control the development in Texas.
Of course, irony is that some of them have distributorships and even retailers in other states, you know, where they're able to be profitable and work in those other states where the laws are more progressive. And so it's just disingenuous, you know, saying the sky's going to fall in Texas if we fix it.
Well, you mentioned that, you know, four of the biggest cities in the union are in Texas. Does that have anything to do with it? I mean, what do you think the reason for Texas being such a strange outlier on this?
Well you just said it.
There's a big market, but also, I mean, I have to, you please fact check me on this, but the last time I looked, I believe 6 out of the 10 largest distributors in the country are in Texas, okay. Texas-based. It's just the laws are extremely favorable to distributors, and also I think that the state, just the geography, is favorable to big beer distributors.
Sure. Well, there's a lot of ground to cover.
And there's been just a ton of consolidation over the last 30, 40 years, and there's just these giant houses now that are extremely powerful and that have long, you know, very long relationships.
So give me a positive. You know, if you had it your way, what would the modern 3-tier laws look like? Because you know, here we're talking about self-distribution, to an extent, there's a cap. Tap room with a cap, 5,000 barrels, which is not small, but it's not huge. It seems like some of that has been allowed, but with certain caps in mind that hurt some people more than others.
Yeah. What's the rub on
some of that for you?
Well, yeah. I mean, so what would be good to, in terms of modernizing the 3-tier system for Texas? It's actually already happened 3 times in Texas. Wineries have been able to sell their product to go in through the wholesale and, you know, direct to consumer. Distilleries can do it. Brew pubs, which are technically retailers under Texas law, they can do it. And so we're actually the only ones in the alcohol industry who don't have the right to do it, mm-hmm. just by right. And so, and it's all because, you know, the law was written and then it was band-aided and then band-aided and then band-aided. And you've just got this incredible web, you know, where if you're between here and here, you can do these things. And if you're between here and here, you can do these things. But if you're between there and there, you can't do any of those things. Right. And it's just a very weird way. And so, you know, simplifying. And then, you know, we actually have, what do we have? 6 different permits from the state of Texas to be able to make and distribute our beer. Hmm. You know, because if it's below 5%, we have to have a manufacturer's permit. And if it's over 5%, we have to have a brewer's permit. And we have to have
distribution permit
for each of those. And then for us to be able to have any warehousing that's not inside of our physical building, we have to have another permit. And they're biannual permits. And I think so total, we're looking at around, oh, I don't know, it's about $6,000 every 2 years for all the different permits that we have to have. And,
that we can warehouse under 5% anywhere in the state. We can only warehouse beer over 5% in our one county.
You're talking ABV.
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so anything over 5% has to be warehoused in our county in a building that's permitted. Over under 5%, we can get a warehouse anywhere in the state.
Is that due to its flammability? What do you think that is?
That's prohibition era laws too, that there's some wet counties and some dry counties and some semi-wet counties that will only have beer but no wine or liquor, and it just, you know.
There are a couple of full dry counties. There are, I believe, 4 counties that allow the sale of 5% or less beer only, and then every other county has some kind of a mix of beer, wine, and liquor.
Mm-hmm. I've seen a little bit of that in Tennessee, where I believe it was Tennessee, where depending on the ABV of your beer, you had to go through a beer distributor or a wine distributor, and most breweries who were coming into that state had to go through both because of it. And so they had competing distributors stocking their beer on a shelf, and you know, sometimes in different areas, sometimes together, but not together. It was incredibly complicated.
Well, now I can answer your question, though, just a little more directly. You said, what needs to happen to really make Texas, and this is my personal vision, what needs to happen to make Texas the best state in the union for beer is, you know, number one, we need consolidation between the permits, because breweries and brew pubs, we do the same thing, but we're treated totally different. And I think we should all be able to do the same things. You know, we have no problem with reasonable caps. You know, those things they already exist in the law, and they exist in 49 other states. We're not trying to reinvent the wheel here, but we should all be treated the same way under the law. Beer and ale, those things need to be the same thing. They have.
Oh, we didn't even touch on that one.
Well, that's what we're talking about, below and above 5%. Yeah. That's the distinction. Beer and ale need to be the same thing, and they need to have the same marketing practices, and they need to be on the same playing field legally. And then the number 3 thing, which is probably the most important thing, you know, franchise law reform in our state. You know, the Beer Industry Fair Dealing Act, I think it was in the late 70s, it was put in, you know, when there were, you know, hundreds of distributors throughout the state and only, you know, a handful of very large brewers. And it was a it was an economic protectionist mechanism that made a lot of sense back when there were hundreds of distributors and a very small number of breweries. But now the shoe's on the other foot, and, you know, the three-tier system exists to prevent undue influence by one very powerful tier over the other tiers. And what that particular set of laws has done is it's created a very powerful middle tier that exerts very strong influence
over the other tiers. Yeah, just as much, if not more.
If not more. Yeah. And that is exactly the antithesis of what the intent of a three-tier system is supposed to do. And so, to me, those are the three things that absolutely have to happen to make the state the best state for craft beer in America.
Or at least not 50th.
I appreciate the education on all that. We've been following along. You know, Dave Eisenberg and Brian Roth and Austin Ray have been trying to keep up with that through our Sightlines news coverage as much as we possibly can. But even then, it's hard to understand the motivations and the strategic value that some of these decisions have for the players involved. I mean, it's been pretty clear that wholesalers are driving a lot of that, but it's not always clear where that pressure comes from onto them as well, because they deal with their own pressure, especially if you're a red or a blue house in some ways, and then what they think the ultimate outcome of some of those things is. Sometimes it seems like they are cutting off their nose despite their face and not necessarily looking too far ahead. My interpretation of most wholesalers when they're pushing it back against this stuff in other states as well is that they're mostly afraid of the radical shift that's occurring in the market because it's happening so quickly and they're not in control of it. Or they fear losing control of it. And so they're kind of just trying to lock it down and make it go slower. When there's a big system like beer, the slower you can force it to evolve, the more value you can extract out of it over time. And that's how most systems kind of function, unfortunately.
No, I think that's very true. And I think trying to understand people's motivations is very difficult, but I think that is a pretty clear cut. There's a group that's had control and power for a long time, and it's treated them extremely well, and they're very profitable, and why would you want to change anything and give up any control or experiment with filling, you know, with changing the laws around when you have a sure thing? And unfortunately, I think that is true with the legislature as well. With many of legislators, distribution lobby is a known entity. It's a small group of extremely powerful players that realize that they depend on the status quo to maintain their position, and they realize that investing political contributions are probably one of the greatest return on their investment of any, of any contributions they could make.
Well, we didn't even touch on the fact that you guys actually formed a PAC.
Absolutely. Yeah.
It's brand new.
It's called Craft PAC. And so in my capacity as a legislative chairman for the Texas Craft Brewers Guild, I was, engaged to start the PAC on behalf of our 250 brewery members. We got it going, just had our kind of official launch not quite 2 weeks ago now, and the response has been fantastic. We've had nearly 200 people make individual contributions from out there. We've raised nearly $10,000, which is a pretty impressive number in 2 weeks. Obviously, $10,000 won't do much, but I think total we've got around $60,000 in our PAC account at this point from brewer contributions as well. That is money that we've already started spreading around this to the state house. We have 150 state representatives and about 31 state senators, and so we have 181 people that we need to focus on. And the primaries are coming up.
That 60K doesn't spread very far, does it?
No, it doesn't. But that's why we need craft beer loving fans all over the place to get involved. There's no limit to how much money a person can donate in Texas for in-state, and you don't actually have to be in-state. We can take donations from people all over the United States. But my challenge to craft brewers from other states who do business in Texas is the things that we want are the things that you want. And if you're interested in seeing your licensing fees go down, and if you want to see your headaches go down to do business in the state of Texas, then we could absolutely use your support as well. Any of our Texas fans who haven't already gone to Craft PAC, please www.craftpac.org. Check it out. We've got a lot of there's a large FAQ section on there, and you can do direct contributions through there as well.
I'm curious to see if that kind of organization around legislation in particular becomes a model, because it does. It sounds like it coordinates with the guild, but it exists on its own with its own initiative.
It does,
and that can, that gives it some freedom to do some things that a guild may not either be prepared to do financially, skill set wise, whatever, it can kind of take on a life of its own.
Absolutely. You know, and our guild exists actually for things other than legislative action. You know, the guild exists for market support. We throw the Texas Craft Brewers Fest every year. It happens in Austin. We're looking to expand that in the future in other cities around the state. It's a fantastic opportunity for craft beer fans to get to experience beers in markets that they wouldn't otherwise get to experience. So that's market development, and that's, you know, I think one of our greatest responsibilities as a state guild. The other thing that we do is education. We have an education and safety summit every year in the summertime where we've got panels of experienced brewers and people from all different types of breweries, small and large, brew pubs and breweries. You know, and we actually have speakers from around the U.S. who come in. This year we've got Bart Watson coming to speak.
Nice.
At our that's actually at our annual meeting, which is happening on the 18th of February.
It must be a hell of a party if Bart's showing up.
It's usually a pretty good time. I'm not going to lie. But, you
double
know,
the security.
We'll have over 500 brewers from across the state in Austin at that annual meeting. And you know, so that's the annual meeting. And then the Education and Safety Summit is about 6 months later. But those are opportunities for, you know, since our industry was only 37 breweries strong 7 years ago, and now we're over 250. There's a lot of youth and you know, some inexperience out there as well. So it's an opportunity for some of us who might have, you know, already gone through those problems to be able to share some of our experience. And, you know, so to me, the guild, you know, exists for very different reasons than what a PAC would exist for.
Yeah.
You know, what we want to do, you know, there is no right or left here. We're not a political organization in that. Rather, we're nonpartisan as right. a political organization. So we're going to be spreading the money to the right and the left. You know, the only thing we truly care about in the PAC is, you know, are you right on beer or are you wrong on beer? Well, let's get you right on it if we can, and let's support the people who are already right on it.
Correct.
You know, we basically become. Yeah. Sorry. Correct. On it. Yeah. Maybe I'm using the wrong nomenclature.
Especially
here.
When you're talking about being bipartisan. Yeah.
Well, we're nonpartisan, actually. Nonpartisan. You know, and I think it's important to mention that, you know, it really doesn't. You know, we're single issue voters when we really get right down to it. We want to make Texas the best state in America for beer. I mean, plain and simple, that is like our mission statement. You know, if we had one, maybe that's it now. So.
Well, good luck with that. Mm. We're rooting for you. It'd be nice to see that one state colored like the rest of them for a change. Thanks for so much for talking with me today. This has been wonderful getting to know you a little bit.
Thanks for having us. That was a random tweet this morning that thanks for reaching out and getting us in on such short notice.
My pleasure. Enjoy yourselves a Half Acre.
Thanks.
Drink some killer beer.
Thank you.
We're all big fans of the podcast, and we're honored to be here, you know?
Nice. So. Well, you get a badge now.
Sweet.
You know, long time listener.
Yeah.
I've got we've got a sticker for you.
You can stick it right on the microphone.
Thanks, Dr. Phil.
Thanks for listening this week, folks. This past week, we published some really interesting pieces on Sightlines challenging the notion of who can claim to be America's stout on St. Patrick's Day. Matthew Curtis gave us a stunning profile of Colorado's Weldworks Brewing, and Brian Alberts made a case for breweries to archive things before it's too late. And then I gave you my read on Chef David Chang's new series on Netflix called Ugly Delicious. It's been a busy week. We also published our latest Fervent Few community article where we sort out the community's opinions on the state of crowdfunding in craft beer. Have perspectives shifted since those early days? Well, they certainly seem to have diversified. If you weren't already aware, we started a subscription club for GBH readers called The Fervent Few, where you can contribute financially to the content you love and get access to exclusive gear, our community forum, and we invite you to share your experience and opinions on a weekly topic. It's been a great way for our readers, together with our writers, to have some compelling discussion. You should join. If you'd like to support GBH, we use Patreon as a way that our readers and listeners can subscribe with a monthly contribution, just like subscribing to a magazine. Visit patreon.com/goodbeerhunting, or to sign up for a yearly subscription, go to goodbeerhunting.com/ferventfew. Our music is produced by Andrew Thibodeau, and our sound engineer is Jordan Stalling of Particle Audio. Aim true, poor liberal folks. Have a great week.